Welcome to this episode of the award-winning Best of the Left podcast, in which we shall take a look at some of the takeaways from the hearings investigating the January 6th insurrection. Most notably, they knew from the very beginning that their fraud claims were nonsense, and they pushed ahead anyway. Clips today are from Fresh Air, Straight White American Jesus, The Bradcast, The Intercept, and The Tom Hartman Program, with an additional members-only clip from Democracy Now!
The storming of the Capitol is not an isolated event. It's the most dramatic, most documented, and most visible and physically threatening part of the larger story. But it's just one part. So how do you see the insurrection as fitting into the larger months-long story in the attempt to overthrow the results of the election?
Well, it's the culmination of everything that came before it. And basically, the Trump campaign had run out of options at that point. At first, they had tried to keep the former president in power through the courts. You know, right away on election night, Donald Trump announces that he won the election, and despite what the votes say. And so they try lawsuit after lawsuit to try to keep him in power. And that's the legitimate way to do it, right? I mean, these lawsuits were very dubious and they were bogus, but that is the proper remedy to try to contest an election, is to go to the courts. And they try some 60 plus times and fail each time. Each one of these suits is thrown out. After that happens, they try schemes that are increasingly at odds with norms, standards, and the law. So they then come up with this idea that, well, if the courts won't go along with this, it's because they haven't seen the evidence of fraud that we believe exists. And in order to get that evidence of fraud, we need to take control of the voting machines, because there must be fraud. So they strategize with a number of theories for how they can take control of various voting machines. Obviously, this is a very dangerous and frightening plan. And at first, we believed it was mainly pushed by people with extreme views. But through reporting, we've been able to determine that Donald Trump himself actually entertained this plan and checked with three different agencies to see if they would carry it out. And each one rejected these attempts to seize voting machines. And so that plan sort of dies in the water once he can't get any of his agency heads to go along with it.
So when previous efforts to overturn the election failed, then there was the effort to submit fake electors to the Electoral College so that the Biden electors wouldn't be getting to vote. Trump electors would be getting to vote. So tell us how that figures in.
So yes, after the Trump campaign realizes they cannot win through the courts or through seizing voting machines, they have to come up with a different strategy to keep Donald Trump in power, if that's their goal. And one idea they settle on is to have their lawyers fan out across the country and contact Republicans in seven different battleground states that were all won by Joe Biden, and convince them to meet and certify slates of electors for President Trump instead of Joe Biden, and then send those slates to the Congress and to the National Archives. But in order for this plan to have any legitimacy, they need the governors of those states or the state legislatures to approve of these slates, to say, yes, in fact, there was a contested election here. We have two slates of electors. We don't know which one is right. Here, Congress, please decide for us. The problem for Donald Trump is no one's willing to go along with that plan. They do get the fake electors to sign these certificates, but no governor and no legislature is willing to meet to sign off on them. So they don't have any legitimacy once they get to Washington. And that's when Donald Trump becomes, one, enraged at those people who won't go along with it. You know, I recall Governor Kemp of Georgia receiving a lot of ire from the president because he would not acquiesce. Then they have to come up with a different way to try to keep him in power, to say, well, maybe we don't need to get governors to sign off on them. Maybe we can just have Vice President Mike Pence accept these fake electors and throw out legitimate votes. And that's when the pressure really turns to Mike Pence.
And Pence decides, like, he can't go forward with that. It's not legal. And he decides that after talking with his lawyers and with former Vice President Dan Quayle. And then Trump gets really angry with Pence and even says, as they're chanting Mike Pence, even says, maybe they should hang Mike Pence. And we don't know what the tone was when he said that, whether he was saying that in a snarky way or like, I really mean it kind of way. But it is a demonstration of how angry he was. So how does all of this lead to the actual violence, the actual storming of the Capitol, the insurrection on January 6th? Like, where does that fit in to the larger story? Like, connect the dots to that explosion.
Yes. So the only reason to have a crowd assembled in Washington on January 6th is to put pressure on Congress and on Mike Pence specifically to overturn the election. There's never a rally on January 6th any other year. The purpose of that was to bring a crowd to DC and to the Capitol. So the very fact that they've assembled this crowd of thousands creates a sort of very hostile political environment where angry people are being told the election was stolen from them and they're being directed to put pressure on those people inside that building. And Donald Trump directs the crowd to march towards the Capitol that day. Now, when does it get violent? That is a question of substantial investigation and how much planning went into the violence. And what we know now is that several militia groups and hundreds of people did in fact plan to commit violence that day. There's a lot of testimony that federal prosecutors have. There are a lot of guilty pleas coming out of the various court cases where there were some people obviously who did get caught up with the mob, caught up in the moment. Maybe they didn't come to DC that day to commit violence against anyone. But there were people there who did have that plan, and they believed they were carrying out Donald Trump's orders. If you look at, and I believe the January 6th committee at the hearings will play this out in great detail, but there's sort of a call and response dynamic going on between Donald Trump, his public statements, and his tweets in particular, and then how the mob and the violent actors respond to them. For instance, Donald Trump's tweet on December 19th, where he says he encourages people to come to DC and he says it's going to be wild. That really sets in motion the entire rally. Before that, there were no permits filed. There were no travel plans to DC. All of a sudden, you see thousands of actors immediately go into work.
We had the first hearings from the J6 Select Committee. Benny Thompson was the chair and spoke a lot, and him and Liz Cheney were really the ones who were up front and presenting the material, the evidence. There was witness testimony from one of the police officers who was one of the very first to encounter the mob, and also from a documentary filmmaker who provided video footage that had never been seen before. Let me just jump into a couple things that I think are takeaway, like just things that happened last night that are significant. I think there's a lot more to say in terms of analysis, but I think last night we learned a couple things. It's very clear that the J6 committee wants to lay out a case that Trump and his people knew there was no legal basis to challenge the election in conventional ways, that the voter fraud idea was bunk. That the ability for Pence to overturn the election using his role as vice president was outside of legal bounds. And what they did in order to shore this up, and we'll get into the Eastman and the lawyers and that stuff in a minute, but what they did last night to shore this up was they had Trump's people on tape. So we saw Bill Barr, and Bill Barr basically said, hey, when they brought up the Dominion voting machine fraud idea, there was nothing there. That way he called it nonsense. Ivanka Trump said that she followed Bill Barr, and she was pretty much like, you know, he said there was no fraud, and so I'm with him. Alex Cannon, who was a former Trump campaign lawyer, said on video that going back to November 2020, when they were looking for votes and fraud and issues, he was like, I was reporting back to Mark Meadows that I couldn't find anything. So they had Trump's people, one of his kids, his AG, and one of his lawyers, all saying there's no basis for this. So I think there was the legal kind of like dismantling, and then there was the presentation of what was an extra legal conspiracy. And so we've seen this before. We'll talk about it more today. But the second part of last night, to me, was an effort to show that the Proud Boys and Oath Keepers had been planning all of this for months, that there was a movement put in place when Trump said, stand back, stand by at the debate with Biden, that Proud Boys numbers tripled after that. That set in motion a kind of plan to do and what the president needed and to show up where he wanted. And they interpreted that as January 6th. And the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys leaders met at a parking garage on January 5th. There was some kind of planning. It also showed, and I'll throw this to you here in just 1 second, Lee, to get your thoughts. The video footage also showed just how the 300 or so Proud Boys absolutely skipped former President Trump's speech that day, right? So if you think about January 6th and you think about that infamous speech and rally at the Ellipse where Giuliani and Mo Brooks and Trump and all these people are talking, the Proud Boys didn't even go to church. They just went to get the punch and the cake after. I mean, they just walked to the Capitol. And they were ready for battle. I mean, it wasn't like it's not like they listened to Trump, listened to Giuliani, and they were like, okay, yeah, maybe we should spontaneously walk down there and see what happens. There's all the evidence that points to this was planned. And we'll get into this in a second, but this follows on the fact that this week, Enrique Tarrio and a couple of other Proud Boy lieutenants were charged with sedition. I mean, charged essentially with a conspiracy to start this insurrection.
Today's hearing, as I heard it, made clear that not only was it unlawful and unconstitutional for Vice President Pence to overturn the election on his own by refusing to accept, you know, legitimate electoral votes on January 6th, but that everyone knew that, including even the guy who was selling that plan the hardest, Attorney John Eastman and his pal Rudy Giuliani. Again, even they did not believe what they were selling. They all knew that it was wrong, but they did it anyway, and so did Donald Trump. Ultimately, I think that was my major takeaway from Thursday's testimony. Yours?
I think you're absolutely right. That's what we learned, was really the lawyers themselves didn't believe the legal theory that they were flogging. And in fact, there were moments in there, which was one of the more surprising ones that nobody's really talking about, but I thought it was interesting, that they asked Eastman, I think it was Jacob who asked him, you know, well, so what do you think, I mean, can any vice president do this? And he just blatantly said, well, no, Al Gore couldn't have done it. That wouldn't have done it. And Kamala Harris couldn't do that in 2024. But we want you to do it.
Yeah.
I mean, that just is so outlandishly, just blatantly partisan hackery that, you know, it kind of, everything, all the rest of these arguments they were having really seemed superfluous when you realize that that's what they were really arguing about. What they were saying, what Eastman and, of course, Trump were saying, we just want you to do this. We've made up some, you know, sort of, you know, legal excuses why you can do it. But we don't believe those either. What we do believe is that you have the power to do it simply because you are there, you can do it. And what's interesting about that is that there is some acknowledgement, and we've never really discussed what would have happened if he had, right? What were the cascading events that would come from that? Today, for the first time, what we're hearing is that people in the White House were saying, it's going to be taken up in the streets. There are going to be riots. And the answer to that was, yeah, well, we've had political violence before. And I come back to that same thing that I've said many times on this show before. The night before the insurrection, the night before January 5th, Pence came to the White House and had a discussion with Trump about this, and this was all in Bob Woodward and Bob Costa's book, that they had a discussion with him, and he told Mike Pence, you know, why don't you can just do this. And Pence was arguing with him and saying, no, I do not think one man has the authority to do this. We heard that echoed by all of his legal advisors. And Trump said, he's out there, he opens the window, it's cold, you know, they're describing all the details. It's cold outside, he opens the French door, I guess, to the White House, and you can hear the ralliers that were out there the night before, and that was the Proud Boys and all those other people. There was a rally on January 5th, and he said you could hear them outside there kind of talking and yelling and cheering and what have you. And he goes, and Trump said, and as Pence said, well, I don't have the authority to do this. Trump responded, he listened, he goes, what if these people say you do?
Yeah.
And that is really, I think, what we're leading up to is, and I don't know if they're going to say this explicitly in the hearings or whether or not we're all just going to have to, you know, sort of read between the lines here. But they were prepared for insurrection, but not the one they got. They were prepared to do this thing. And then, of course, there would be riots in the street. These 78 million people who just had their election stolen from them
were going to react. Against.
And that is the insurrection that they were planning for.
Yeah, and that would have given Trump the opportunity to declare martial law and do all kinds of other mischief.
Which goes back to the reason why Nancy Pelosi and so forth were concerned about militarizing the Capitol at the time, because they were worried that the military would actually turn against them, perhaps. Or that Donald Trump, at least, would order the military to turn against them.
A significant portion of the first hearing will focus on the Proud Boys, of the first public hearing by the House Select Committee. The Proud Boys are a far-right group. Five members, including the former leader Enrico Tarrio, were indicted on Monday of seditious conspiracy. What does that mean, and why is it so consequential?
Well, it gets beyond the idea that this was a spontaneous attack, that it was just a mob that got out of control. People got too excited that day. This gets to actually the planning of essentially political violence. One thing that's interesting for me to look at, and I think the committee as well, is the connections that the Proud Boys have to Republican politics and connecting the violent extremists and the militia groups with the Republican Party and Republican political actors. So, for instance, Enrico Tarrio and some of the Proud Boys are members of Latinos for Trump. So they were sort of brought into the Trump campaign as a way to motivate supporters and get certain voting blocks to support the president. At the same time, these same people, according to federal prosecutors, are planning a seditious attack on the government. So you have and I think you see a similar thing with the Oath Keepers, where you have the Oath Keepers providing security for Roger Stone, an ally of Donald Trump. And then those same Oath Keepers are seen as part of a very organized force marching into the Capitol that day. So you're seeing an overlap between people in Republican politics and also people as part of these militia or right-wing extremist groups. And I think we're going to see a lot of exploring and investigation of those themes at these hearings.
Yeah, well, the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers are becoming very closely aligned and kind of intermeshed with part of the Republican Party. So, for instance, in Miami-Dade County, several Proud Boys have become part of local politics. About a half a dozen current and former members of the Proud Boys have seats on the Miami-Dade Republican Executive Committee. Has anything like that happened before, or people from such a far-right group have become embedded in the Republican establishment of local politics?
It really is a shocking development. I mean, we're talking about a chapter of the Republican Party, which was once a stronghold of the Bush family, now has five current or former Proud Boys involved. But we're seeing more and more of this, Terry, across the country. The leader of the Republican Party in Wyoming, a fierce opponent of Liz Cheney, is a member of the Oath Keepers. I did a story shortly after the attack on the Capitol where I looked at members of Congress and their connections to these militia groups. And it actually isn't very hard to find examples where members of Congress go to Proud Boy meetings or go to Oath Keeper meetings or go to joint events or have the Oath Keepers provide security for them or the Proud Boys provide security for them. So it is very much, it has been allowed and perhaps even encouraged to bring in these militia groups and bring in these extremist groups into the right flank of the Republican Party.
Famously or infamously, Fox News did not show things from last night. You know, if you went to CNN, MSNBC, CBS, NBC, ABC, it was all there. And then, you know, if you had 20 TVs, Fox would have been the only one that was doing something different. Tucker Carlson was on. They did no commercials, Leah. So they were like, we don't want to give people a reason.
That is fascinating.
To like go away from Fox for 90 seconds, find themselves at one of those liberal networks like ABC or NBC. And start watching the J6 hearing. So they did no commercials. Okay. And they did show like footage from the hearings, but it wasn't the same perspective. So they were like showing the backs of people's heads as they were testifying when the previously unseen footage of J6 insurrection was being aired. They were showing the people's reactions, not the video. They didn't want the audience to see the actual video. Right. Now, a couple points here, and I'll throw it to you. And I'm really curious what you think, especially given just kind of some of your background in performance aesthetics and so on. Is, you know, there's a piece at the Washington Post that says there's a big problem here, and that Fox didn't show it. Fox has, you know, Tucker Carlson gets 3 million people a night, and so on and so forth, and that highlights the fact that Democrats just cannot get around that information echo chamber. That the game has been already set and already tilted because. Through generations of building their media networks and empires, the right in this country has found a way to cordon people off, to make sure they don't actually see the footage that the rest of the country is seeing, right? So I think that's an issue that's worth talking about. I also think it's worth talking about something that folks who don't watch Fox News probably don't know. Tucker Carlson's guests last night was Darren Beatty. So Darren Beatty, you know, was a White House appointee and a former staffer for Matt Gaetz. So this is the guy that was on last night with Tucker Carlson as these things were happening. What were some things that he was tweeting during the Capitol insurrection on January 6th? He was tweeting this, and there's some vulgar language and strong language ahead, friends. Okay. So he tweeted, Tim Scott needs to learn his place and take a knee to MAGA. Tim Scott is a black man, a politician. Black Lives Matter must take a knee to MAGA. They must learn their place. Ibram Kendi is an academic and a public intellectual who writes about anti-racism, also a black man, needs to learn his place and take a knee to MAGA. K. Cole James of Heritage Foundation needs to learn her natural place and take a knee to MAGA. Darren Beatty writes for something called Revolver News. Revolver News is basically a conspiracy theory site that has, among other things, pushed the false flag narrative that J6 was an inside job. So if you go to revolver.news, which you can if you want, but I'll save you the trip. There's a lot of headlines about how J6 was an inside job, that Stuart Rhodes from the Oath Keepers may be an FBI informant, that certain people you see on the videos from J6 are conspicuous, and that if you look closely this, and then if you do that here, and then, oh, there, it's very clear that the man who had his like feet on Nancy Pelosi's desk is actually from the FBI, right? That is who Tucker Carlson had. So it was not just that they didn't show it. It's that, Leah, they did no ads, and they brought on this man who is a white supremacist and a conspiracy theorist. And that is how Fox News reacted. And I think, just speaking of history, we should note that. But I also think in terms of performance and framing and aesthetics, there's a lot there. So any thoughts on that? I know, sorry. It's a lot. Anything, you know, you don't have to cover it all, but just, you know, what's going through your head as you think about any of that?
Well, I hope your listeners appreciate your really excellent instincts about where to go, you know, like how to think through what was happening in the Fox News media world, because I want to be careful with my language here. Admiration isn't appreciation for the skill level of the folks over at Fox.
Yeah.
I mean, we can't say enough about that, because they understand their audience so well, and they have very creatively figured out how to ensure that the Fox News bubble stays intact, which is no small accomplishment in this world that we live in. So I think you're so right to point out those details, you know, like who did they have on? How did they do their formatting? And the tone, I think, is really interesting, because the Tucker Carlson tone is just like one straight rage fest. And I think that is probably their best, get in terms of like who can compete with police officers at the Capitol talking about, you know, their experiences. I would never, but if I were a Fox News person, I could totally see why this is the direction that they went. One of the things that I've been thinking about, about this coordinated effort, you know, a lot of my research, and I know yours too, looks at how these media networks have coalesced and formed, cooperating relationships with what we would think of as quote unquote the religious right, which that could be defined in many different ways, but also just how the length of these relationships, it goes back much further than television, radio, paper publications. So you're so right. This is a really long-standing effort.
After Monday's hearing, Trump released a pretty silly 12-page rebuttal to the hearings to date. I don't know if you put yourself through reading it. We did, and we rebutted his dumb rebuttal on our previous broadcast. But one of his complaints that has been echoed on Fox News, or vice versa, by the way, is that, you know, he isn't allowed to bring rebuttal witnesses to all of this. There's no one to cross-examine the committee's witnesses, even though I should add that it is a bipartisan committee. But does Trump and, I guess, Fox News have a point here? Would the case being made by the J6 committee be stronger if that happened, even if only to sort of take away the bad faith talking point from Trump and his MAGA party? Because that sort of seems like all they have left at this point. Oh, it's so political. You know, there's no one there to cross-examine witnesses and so forth.
Oh, they whined about this stuff in committee hearings throughout Trump's presidency. And in the impeachment hearings, I mean, there's always something, right? And the fact is that he needs to take that up with Kevin McCarthy, because Kevin McCarthy and the whole Republican, you know, party in the Congress rejected the idea of a bipartisan, independent bipartisan commission, which would have had an equal number. They all would have had to agree on what they were presenting. It all would have been done very differently than this one. And they rejected that idea. And that's because Kevin McCarthy wanted to put a bunch of people who were involved in January 6th on the actual committee. And, you know, and then he ended up taking his ball and going home. So he has no one to blame but his own people. But more importantly than that, the witnesses that they are using in this, has there been even one Democrat even appearing in any of these hearings other than...
Nope.
Than the people that are on the panel, and even that, it's only been two. It's been Benny Thompson, and today it was Congressman Aguilar. It's all Republicans. These are all people, you know. And I guess Trump's out there screaming, "They're all a bunch of rhinos."
Yeah.
But at some point, people in the country have got to go, wait a minute, this is his own staff. These are Republican officials. These are people who, you know, I guess there was the Capitol policewoman who mm-hmm. testified in the first hearing. Other than that, though, this has been Republicans making the case. Now, you can call that political if you want, but it's a kind of a strange definition of, you know, partisanship in my view.
Well,
so I don't think they have a leg to stand on
that. I will add, it might be a strange definition of partisanship, but that is what they do. Anyone who would testify against Donald Trump is not a real Republican. They're all rhinos.
Right.
Even at the end of Thursday's hearings, channel you were watching on. I was watching on Fox News today. And at the end of the hearing, Judge Luttig said something like, Donald Trump presents a clear and present danger to the United States. But he added that the danger is not so much what he did in 2020. The danger is what he and his supporters are now planning to do in 2024. And over on Fox News, constitutional attorney, so-called Jonathan Turley, said he was very surprised that the committee would want to become so political at the end, even though it was actually the conservative judge, Michael Luttig, who raised that point. And frankly, it's not a political point as I see it. That's about the Constitution and democracy. No, I mean, are the American people dumb enough to see all of this as merely a political exercise? Or am I wrong? And that's what it actually is.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, yeah, if you're watching Fox News, what you see is Jonathan Turley saying, oh, it's so political.
Don't pay attention to this.
They put on these partisans here who are just, you know, giving the political line, which, of course, is ridiculous. I mean, J. Michael Luttig, I mean, it's like they might as well have dredged up Antonin Scalia from the grave and put him up there and had him making those comments.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, I don't agree with Luttig. I'm sure my colleague here on this program doesn't agree with Michael Luttig, but, you know, on many issues. But on this is what you call, I don't know, you know, nonpartisanship, right? I mean, it's not partisan. It's anything but partisan because you've got that guy making the case that these people were putting their own, you know, Trump was putting his own political future, his own political well-being, and the party, by the way, was putting their own political well-being above the country. That's the case that's being made, and it's being made by Republicans and arch conservatives who are making that case. So, you know, I mean, sure, they're going to say that on Fox, but, you know, what are we going to do? You know, what can you do about that? That's just what they do, and you just got to carry on and hope that a few people out here in the country are somehow listening or getting some inkling of what's going on and kind of go, well, that's weird. You know, that's a Republican guy, isn't he? You know, and hopefully we'll maybe think a little bit. I don't know. History will certainly show it to be that.
One of the things I'd like to talk about with both of you is this question of the disparity in treatment between the January 6th defendants and defendants in other types of prosecutions. And so Margot, as you mentioned earlier, you and I work on this database at The Intercept called Trial and Terror, where we track international terrorism prosecutions and, you know, federal prosecutions of people alleged to have, you know, literal or ideological connections to Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and other groups. And what we see in those is something very different than what we see in the January 6th cases. You know, and this relates specifically to what you mentioned earlier, where, you know, there we're seeing a large number, if not half of the total in January 6th, being charged with misdemeanors, which is not at all a common charge in terrorism prosecutions. And what we're also not seeing in the January 6th data compared to terrorism prosecutions are a common charge that prosecutors bring known as making false statements or otherwise known colloquially as lying to the FBI. And I was wondering what your thoughts are on this disparity in treatment. You know, given that I think we might be seeing something very different if it was a group of alleged ISIS associates who stormed the Capitol, or maybe even a group of Black and Brown, Black Lives Matter demonstrators.
Well, another difference that I see is that in the charges against the terrorists, the international terrorists, there are so many sting cases, and here there are no stings. And also, here in the few cases that have gone to a conclusion, we see people who have actually had weapons with them, and weapons, you know, weapons of mass destruction as one of the terrorism charges that could be brought, but it wasn't in this case. So there are differences. I believe that these cases, the similarities are in the rounding up of people who seemingly have little connection to many other things, and that both have kind of charges that now, looking at our cases in the trial and terror, they would have been considered misdemeanors, except that the extra allegation that people were somehow involved with an overseas group, even though they didn't go overseas, makes it a much tougher charge than being engaged with Oath Keepers or Proud Boys. Although it looks like this week that Oath Keepers and Proud Boys are going to start having more prosecutions will be involved with belonging to those groups, even though they're not known as terrorist groups. But in the hearings, they started to make it sound like they're similar to what would be called a terrorist group.
Yeah, similarly, Michael, I mean, are you seeing disparities in the January 6th prosecutions compared to, you know, your research on J20 or the summer of 2020 prosecutions?
Yeah, I mean, the comparison between the Floyd prosecutions is I think apt because, you know, they're both, you know, somewhat constrained events, but they couldn't have been prosecuted in different ways. You know, the summer 2020 Floyd cases, you know, really followed some pretty clear patterns of overcharging, an attempt to get, you know, plea bargains. We certainly, you know, had a lot of cases that were dropped, especially at the non-federal level, but even at the federal level, we had these, you know, in the Floyd cases, we had these seemingly, not in all cases, but in many cases, seemingly minor crimes, which were sort of saddled with the much larger political, ongoing. So, for example, you'd have a document, a statement of facts document or an affidavit, which, you know, would talk about all of the destruction given to the Portland courthouse. And then when you got to the actual actions of that particular defendant, it was relatively minor. So you had this kind of individual saddled with a much larger and, you know, in a sense, scarier political context. Here you have, you know, something different in the capital cases where, you know, as Margo said, about half the people are charged with relatively minor crimes, and we'll never expect to see, the inside of a jail cell, let alone a prison sentence. So most of these people haven't been sentenced yet. But I just did a quick calculation on our, you know, length of prison sentence variable, and there are so many people that got no prison time that the mathematical average is zero at this point, because, you know, most people received no prison time. So I think that's certainly a major difference is that, you know, we have a handful of cases in which people have the potential of having multi-year sentences. Whereas in the Floyd cases, if you look just at the summer ones, you know, most of those were pretty, pretty steep charges. And again, a lot of them have been pled down, but I think the vigor, if I can say, the vigor through which the Department of Justice and the United States Attorney's Office pursued those cases seems to have been pretty, pretty high. And, you know, as Margo said, the kind of investigative complexity of some of the summer 2020 cases was really quite impressive. Whereas in the capital cases, you know, most of these things are a combination of monitoring people's own social media, people being snitched on by their friends and relatives, which is by far the most common way people seem to have been caught, and, you know, simple geofencing of their phones and things like that. So the kind of like broad stroke investigative approach of the capital cases, you know, partially because everyone's constrained in the same physical area versus the, you know, deep dive investigations of the summer 2020 cases stands out to me as a really odd kind of uneven allocation of resources.
Five retired American generals: Michael Hayden, James Clapper, Stanley McChrystal, Douglas Lute, and Mark Hertling wrote an op-ed titled, "We Fought to Defend Democracy. This New Threat to America Now Keeps Us Awake at Night." What are they talking about? They're talking about this fascist element that has seized control of the Republican Party, principally in the persona of Donald Trump, but broadly I mean, Trump could drop dead of one too many cheeseburgers tonight, and his movement will live on tomorrow. It no longer needs Donald Trump. In fact, I've been telling you for 2 years now that Donald Trump is not going to be the nominee of the Republican Party in 2024. I wouldn't surprise me if his son is the nominee for vice president. I don't think he's going to be the president. But the movement that he has created, this fascist movement that he has created in this country, it is growing. Because as I noted, in the first hour, fascism, fascism is all about violence, and the violence that fascism uses actually attracts people. It's the most powerful recruiting tool fascists have, is their own violence. Because you get all these insecure men who feel like their lives are dull and ordinary and boring and feel like they're politically impotent and perhaps sexually impotent in some cases, but politically impotent. And the violence gives them meaning. I mean, I realize I'm kind of playing off Chris Hedges, the title of Chris Hedges' book, War is a Force That gives Life Meaning or Gives Us Meaning, but it's absolutely the case. And of course, war is simply violence, and fascism is simply war being used in politics and in governance. These five generals, they wrote, "Today we harbor unprecedented concern for our country and for our democracy. The nation we have defended for decades is in real peril." Now, I'm telling you, when five retired generals come out and say something like that, we damn well better pay attention. They go on to say, "History teaches us that democracy is never guaranteed. Not even here. Our democratic institutions and norms are more vulnerable than ever. If you were to ask us when in our lives we were most likely to be losing sleep at night," and keep in mind, these are all men who have been on the battlefield, who have lived through some of the biggest crises in American history. Through 9/11, through the assassination of Kennedy, through the Cuban Missile Crisis, on and on. They say, if you were to ask us when in our lives we were most likely to be losing sleep at night, we would all tell you last night and tonight and tomorrow night. They go on to say, for those of us devoted to protecting democracies abroad, there comes a time when our efforts seem overshadowed by the erosion of democracy here at home. You get this? This is the point I'm making. And with my op-ed this morning at HartmanReport.com, that talks about, is America getting meaner? That basically fascism is sweeping this land. And it is replacing democracy. We have a half a dozen states now that have passed laws saying that it doesn't matter who the people vote for as president. We, the state legislature, are going to decide how we cast our vote in the Electoral College. You've got almost 30 states that have passed laws making it harder for people to vote. Explicitly, intentionally, proudly. Yes, let's whittle down democracy to the size where we can drown it in the bathtub, to paraphrase Grover Norquist. They go on to say, and for those of us focused on domestic security, speaking of them, these five generals, and for those of us focused on domestic security, the forces of autocracy now trump traditional foreign threats hands down. In other words, you have more to fear from the militia driving around your town with a bunch of guys with AR-15s in the back seat, in the back of a pickup truck and big Trump and American flags. You have more to fear from them than from ISIS, from Al-Qaeda, from the Chinese army, from the Russian army, fill in the blanks, right? They go on to point out, it is no accident. I mean, these guys are, this is their way of writing my op-ed. It is no accident, they write in USA Today today, it is no accident that one in three Americans seem willing to justify political violence as a means of overturning election results. You get it? These guys are saying, we're talking about you, Donald Trump, and your followers. You have put our democracy at such risk that we, five highly decorated generals, are saying it is a greater threat to the United States than Russian nuclear weapons. It is a greater threat to the United States than 17 Saudis flying airplanes into buildings in New York City. It is a greater threat to the United States than the blind sheikh trying to blow up the trade center. It's a greater threat to the United States than the infiltration of our government computer systems by Russian cyber hackers. It's a greater threat to the United States than China militarizing the South China Sea and the Straits of Taiwan. It's a greater threat to the United States than Ebola or COVID or monkeypox or whatever. Trumpism, fascism, these five generals are saying. My words, not theirs, but this is the essence of what they are saying. Is here and is keeping them up at night, and they are saying that this is the greatest threat they have seen in their lifetimes. These are all men in their 60s and 70s. They end on a voice of hope, I suppose you could say. They say a clear majority of Americans favor strengthening our democracy rather than weakening it. Imagine the impact on our lawmakers if each of them heard from each of us with the simplest of all messages. And then they're talking about the SAFE pledge. They you know, which is a nice nonpartisan initiative, but, you know, frankly, it's not going to do anything. The only way you stop fascists is by outlawing fascism.
The January 6th committee revealed six members of Congress who supported Trump's coup attempts sought presidential pardons. Mo Brooks of Alabama, Matt Gaetz of Florida, Louis Gohmert of Texas, Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia, Scott Perry of Pennsylvania, and Andy Biggs of Arizona. This is Republican Congressmember Adam Kinzinger.
My colleagues and I up here also take an oath. Some of them failed to uphold theirs and instead chose to spread the big lie. Days after the tragic events of January 6th, some of these same Republican members requested pardons in the waning days of the Trump administration. 5 days after the attack on the Capitol, Representative Mo Brooks sent the email on the screen now. As you see, he emailed the White House, quote, pursuant to a request from Matt Gaetz, requesting a pardon for Representative Gaetz himself and unnamed others. Witnesses told the Select Committee that the president considered offering pardons to a wide range of individuals connected to the president. Let's listen to some of that testimony.
And was Representative Gaetz requesting a pardon?
Believe so. The general tone was, we may get prosecuted because we were defensive of, you know, the president's positions on these things. The pardon that he was discussing, requesting, was as broad as you could describe from the beginning. I remember he's from the beginning of time up until today, for any and all things. I think he mentioned Nixon, and I said Nixon's pardon was never nearly that broad.
And are you aware of any members of Congress seeking pardons?
Mr. Gaetz and Mr. Brooks, I know, have both advocated for there to be a blanket pardon for members involved in that meeting and a handful of other members that weren't at the December 21st meeting. as the preemptive pardons. Mr. Gates was personally pushing for a pardon, and he was doing so since early December. I'm not sure why. Mr. Gates had reached out to me to ask if he could have a meeting with Mr. Meadows about receiving a presidential pardon.
They all contacted you?
Not all of them, but several of them did.
So you mentioned Mr. Gates, Mr. Brooks.
Mr. Gates did. Mr. Jordan talks about congressional pardons, but he never asked me for one. It was more for an update on whether the White House is going to pardon members of Congress. Mr. Gomer asked for one as well.
That's Cassidy Hutchinson, a former aide to White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, in her videotaped deposition. Oh, and before her, senior White House legal advisor Eric Hirschman. To see Thursday's full hearing, go to democracynow.org, as well as all five of the hearings in full. The public hearings of the January 6th committee will resume in mid-July.
What's coming up next is one or more segments that were originally only for members, but since this is a reposted episode, I've unlocked them for everyone. Enjoy, and if you like getting the extra content, think about becoming a member yourself.
After the election, you received a phone call from President Trump and Rudy Giuliani, in which they discussed the result of the presidential election in Arizona. If you would, tell us about that call. And whether the former president or Mr. Giuliani raised allegations of election fraud.
Thank you. My wife and I had returned from attending our church meetings. It was on a Sunday. And we were still in the driveway, and I had received a call from a colleague telling me that the White House was trying to get in touch with her and I, and that she said, please, if you get a call, let's try to take this together. Immediately, I saw that the White House on my Bluetooth was calling, and I took the call and was asked by the operator at the White House, if I would hold for the president, which I did, and Mr. Giuliani came on first, and niceties, then President Trump came on, and we initiated a conversation.
And during that conversation, you will ask Mr. Giuliani for proof of these allegations of fraud that he was making?
On multiple occasions, yes.
And when you asked him for evidence of this fraud, what did he say?
He said that they did have proof, and I asked him, do you have names? For example, we have 200,000 illegal immigrants, some large number, 5,000 or 6,000 dead people, etc. And I said, do you have their names? Yes. Will you give them to me? Yes. The president interrupted and said, give the man what he needs, Rudy. He said, I will. And that happened on at least two occasions, that interchange in the conversation.
So Mr. Giuliani was claiming in the call that there were hundreds of thousands of undocumented people and thousands of dead people who had purportedly voted in the election?
Yes.
And you asked him for evidence of that.
I did.
And did you ever receive from him that evidence either during the call, after the call, or to this day?
Never.
What was the ask during this call? He was making these allegations of fraud, but he had something or a couple things that they wanted you to do. What were those?
The ones I remember were first that we would hold, that I would allow an official committee at the Capitol so that they could hear this evidence and that we could take action thereafter. And I refused. I said, up to that time, the circus, I called it a circus, had been brewing with lots of demonstrations, both at the counting center, at the Capitol, and other places. And I didn't want to have that in the House. I did not feel that the evidence, granted in its absence, merited a hearing, and I didn't want to be used as a pawn if there was some other need that the committee hearing would fulfill. So that was the first ask, that we hold an official committee hearing. And what was his second ask?
I said, to what end? To what end the hearing? He said, well, we have heard by an official high up in the Republican legislature that there is a legal theory or a legal ability in Arizona that you can remove the electors of President Biden and replace them. And we would like to have the legitimate opportunity through the committee to come to that end and remove that. And I said, that's totally new to me. I've never heard of any such thing. And he pressed that point. And I said, look, you are asking me to do something that is counter to my oath when I swore to the Constitution to uphold it. And I also swore to the Constitution and the laws of the state of Arizona. And this is totally foreign as an idea or a theory to me. And I would never do anything of such magnitude without deep consultation with qualified attorneys. And I said, I've got some good attorneys and I'm going to give you their names. But you are asking me to do something against my oath and I will not break my oath. And I think that was up to that point.
During the conversation, and you heard, I think, when we played a snippet of Mr. Giuliani calling other state legislators and saying that he was calling as essentially a fellow Republican, did he make a similar appeal to you or bring up the fact that you shared a similar party?
Whether it was in that call or in a later meeting, he did bring that up more than once.
And how would he bring that up?
He would say, aren't we all Republicans here? I would think we would get a better reception. I mean, I would think you would listen a little more open to my suggestions that we're all Republicans.
And this evidence that you asked him for that would justify this extraordinary step, I think you said they never produced. Why did you feel, either in the absence of that evidence, or with it, what they were asking you to do would violate your oath to the Constitution?
First of all, when the people, and in Arizona, I believe it was some 40 plus years earlier, the legislature had established the manner of electing our officials, or the electors for the presidential race. Once it was given to the people, as in Bush v. Gore, illustrated by the Supreme Court, it becomes a fundamental right of the people. So as far as I was concerned, for someone to ask me in the, I would call it a paucity, there was no evidence being presented of any strength. Evidence can be hearsay evidence. It's still evidence, but it's still hearsay. But strong judicial quality evidence, anything that would say to me, you have a doubt, deny your oath. I will not do that. And on more than one occasion throughout all this, that has been brought up, and it is a tenet of my faith that the Constitution is divinely inspired. Of my most basic foundational beliefs. And so for me to do that because somebody just asked me to is foreign to my very being. I will not do it.
Republican Arizona House Speaker Rusty Bowers, a longtime Trump supporter, testifying Tuesday to the House January 6th committee. He was questioned by Democratic Congress member Adam Schiff, who also asked Bowers about threats he and his family faced after he refused Trump's request to overturn the 2020 election.
Mr. Bowers, I understand that as you flew from Phoenix to Washington yesterday, you reflected upon some passages from a personal journal that you were keeping in December 2020 while all of this was taking place. With your permission, I'm wondering if you would be willing to share one passage in particular with us.
Thank you very much. It is painful to have friends who have been such a help to me
turn on me with such rancor. I may, in the eyes of men, not hold correct opinions or act according to their vision or convictions, but I do not take this current situation in a light manner, a fearful manner, or a vengeful manner. I do not want to be a winner by cheating. I will not play with laws I swore allegiance to, with any contrived desire towards deflection of my deep foundational desire to follow God's will as I believe he led my conscience to embrace. How else will I ever approach him in the wilderness of life, knowing that I ask this guidance only to show myself a coward in defending the course he led me to take.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Those are powerful words. I understand that taking the courageous positions that you did following the 2020 election in defense of the rule of law and protecting the voters of Arizona resulted in you and your family being subjected to protests and terrible threats. Can you tell us how this impacted you and your family?
Well, as others in the videos have mentioned, we received, my secretaries would say, in excess of 20,000 emails and tens of thousands of voicemails and texts, which saturated our offices and we were unable to work, or at least communicate. But at home, up till even recently, it is the new pattern or a pattern in our lives to worry what will happen on Saturdays, because we have various groups come by and they have had video panel trucks with videos of me proclaiming me to be a pedophile and a pervert and a corrupt and politician, and blaring loudspeakers in my neighborhood and leaving literature both on my property, but arguing and threatening with neighbors and with myself. And I don't know if I should name groups, but there was one gentleman that had the three bars on his chest and he had a pistol and was threatening my neighbor, not with the pistol, but just vocally. When I saw the gun, I knew I had to get close. And at the same time, on some of these, we had a daughter who was gravely ill, who was upset by what was happening outside. And my wife, that was a valiant person, very, very strong, quiet, very strong woman. So it was disturbing.